Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing alternative points of view into challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. You would think that, in light of the recent guilty verdicts in the Derek Chauvin murder trial, and as the police killing of yet another black person here in Columbus on the day the verdicts were read, that local media would be ablaze with news and discussions about the underlying issues and future plans regarding policing and criminal justice reform. Had the Chauvin trial gone the other way and had Chauvin been acquitted, we know there would have been demonstrations all over the country, much as there were when the four California police officers who beat Rodney King nearly to death were acquitted, despite a witness's video showing them clubbing King, who was sprawled on the ground, not resisting, but pleading for his life. Then, of course, the local media would have no choice but to cover the protests and the police response to those protests and the local issues that make the protests of that sort necessary. There would be press conferences and statements from the mayor and the city council and from Congressperson Joyce Beatty, who chairs the Democratic National Congress. But since justice prevailed in Minnesota, the streets are relatively calm across the country as we breathe a momentary sigh of relief. We celebrate, not as though a victory had been won or as if any great progress had been made, it really hasn't after all, but simply to mark the minor milestone in police accountability. Derek Chauvin and his accomplices murdered George Floyd while being filmed, we all saw that, and the jury agreed, but while justice is being served upon that one individual, suppose there had not been an eyewitness video, and instead only verbal accounts, would there even have been a trial? The initial police report said that Floyd's death stated simply that he had been taken into custody and subsequently died. And in many ways, the trial continues in the court of public opinion, as there have been many who remain unaffected by the factual information presented in the court and who cling to prejudiced beliefs that were resolutely contradicted by the facts, such as that Floyd died from a drug overdose or that he died from a heart attack that had nothing to do with four police officers sitting on his chest and his neck. Further still, there are those who use George Floyd's drug addiction and past criminal record as excuses for saying of him what they clearly think of all black people, that he was a burden to society anyway, and he needed to be removed for the sake of the rest of us, and by that they mean white people, but specifically white people who share their particular misanthropic views and visceral hatreds. On the justice side, others note that convicting one killer cop is not reform, and that may not even lead to reforms directly. They note that, well, killers must be held accountable, and that the Chauvin convictions chip away at the monolith of police impunity, fundamental rather than topical shifts in the role of policing and our approaches to crime and public safety are needed. Several bills are advancing in the state legislature that are aimed at doing that, but none are fully comprehensive. We note that this is the first time such bills have been presented, and so it is a start, but procedural reforms that leave the underlying inequalities intact can only do so much. And then, of course, there are the so-called riots, the destruction of property that ensues sometimes when police attack protesters, often catalyzed by the actions of just a few provocateurs, and which enlist participation from both opportunists and from people whose patience is simply run out and who feel deprived of any means of gaining a meaningful audience with elected officials. Martin Luther King called riots the language of the unheard, and we're still burdened with vast armies of the unlistening. And lastly, you would think that in the midst of all of this, community radio would be playing a crucial role as a loyal platform for the outspoken, from which to speak truth to power, and as a resource through which power in the community can be built, a partner in the movement, if you will, and a megaphone through which the voices of the aggrieved can be heard clearly as opposed to the handheld units that protesters too often default to, that few know how to use, that make the speeches unlistenable. Hence, I've tried to line up local interviews with activists and organizers for today's show, but unfortunately, community media just doesn't seem to be high on most people's lists of priorities. There is general distrust of the media and a failure to distinguish between sympathetic and obtuse media outlets, maybe a fear that people's words will be twisted or that they'll be allowed only sound bites compared to the opposing or establishment views, which have their own ample platforms anyway. I wasn't able to get the desired cooperation today, or find people who were available, and so I don't have any local interviews, though I did spend the better part of the day trying. I hope that someday the people making a difference in the community will appreciate the potential of community radio and the work of folks trying to maintain a different media model. We have in this show, then, some background explanation of the technicalities of the Chauvin trial, published just days before the verdicts, and which should clear up any misunderstandings people might have about the role and limits of law in the prosecution. And we have responses to the verdict from Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison and Congressperson Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I would like to comment on the latest police shooting in Columbus, but I don't feel qualified to do so meaningfully, and I had hoped to rely on the insights of folks I would have interviewed locally. I will say that police explanation that they killed somebody who they perceived as about to stab someone else and that there was no time to de-escalate appears plausible judging from the body cam footage alone. But there are many variables that we don't know, starting with what did the police dispatcher say to the responding officers that may have influenced their approach. Once on the scene, were alternatives to lethal force possible? Was it necessary to fire four shots, or might one have sufficed? And what was the responsibility of the half dozen or so people who were standing there in close proximity? Could they have de-escalated the situation themselves or disarmed the person with the knife, who may have been acting in self-defense there anyway? Might they have had some responsibility here? For now, I have only questions, and so I won't offer an opinion, even speculatively. We do know, however, that this does not alter the broader context wherein police killings are an ongoing problem rooted in a fundamental disconnect that places the police and communities of color in adversarial roles, and where trust, instead of being a two-way street, is a dead-end alley littered with broken dreams and bodies. Well, here to explain in legal terms the technicalities of the Chauvin case is Virginia School of Law Professor Anne Coughlin.
All of you will be familiar with the core concepts in a general kind of way. And that is, the case involves homicide charges. It involves both murder and manslaughter charges. And you'll be familiar with the terms murder, manslaughter, murder in the first degree, murder in the second degree, manslaughter in the first, manslaughter in the second. If you are a student of popular culture or just a person who watches television, police procedurals, these are terms that you'll be familiar with. And that understanding is not unhelpful. The problem is that that kind of general understanding really doesn't get you where you need to go. In any criminal case in the United States, you need to focus on the law of the state where the homicide occurred and where the trial is taking place. And of course, that brings us to Minnesota and the particular definitions of homicide that are codified in the Minnesota Penal Code and that have been alleged in the criminal complaint against Derek Chauvin and in criminal complaints against his accomplices. So Chauvin faces three counts of homicide. Two of the counts are murder counts, and one of the counts is a manslaughter count. So he is charged with murder in the second degree, and that is what I will call the felony murder count. The charge there is that he committed a felony, that is, he assaulted George Floyd, and in the course of committing that felony, he caused the death of George Floyd. So the prosecution has to prove that he committed conduct with criminal intent that amounts to an assault, and that he caused the death of George Floyd. The third degree murder count is a really interesting account, and it will be obscure to many of you because this does not get mentioned in the popular culture as much as often. But this third degree murder count is what we will call the depraved mind count. And this is a theory of homicide that requires the state to prove that the defendant here, Derek Chauvin, caused the death of another person. And he did so by engaging in conduct that is highly dangerous and that evinces a depraved mind, that evinces callous and wanton disregard for the value of human life. So we have the felony murder count, the depraved mind murder count, and then he's also been charged with second degree manslaughter, which says that he, with culpable negligence, caused the death of another human being, that is George Floyd. So one thing that you want to notice right away about these homicide charges, which have distinct elements, they are alternative and distinct ways of proving up a homicide case against Derek Chauvin. You'll notice that none of these counts requires that the state prove that Derek Chauvin had a purpose or an intent to kill George Floyd. And you might be wondering why the state didn't charge him with intentional or purposeful homicide, having watched the video, if you watched the video. As I mentioned, the video is absolutely excruciating to watch. And in the video, as the time ticks by, as Chauvin continues to apply force and pressure to George Floyd's neck, which goes on, as you know, for roughly 9 minutes, you begin to think, well, surely that would create an inference beyond a reasonable doubt that his purpose was to kill or that he intended to kill George Floyd. And we can talk about that question later if you'd like. Should the state have brought a charge of intentional homicide, which would have allowed perhaps a first degree murder charge, if you could show a special kind of intent known as premeditation, or just a second degree count based on intent to kill? But the state decided not to bring those charges. And from where I sit, I can understand why. It's going to be difficult given Derek Chauvin's occupation, his role here as a police officer. It's going to be difficult to show that his purpose was to kill George Floyd. The defense will obviously would argue strenuously that his purpose was to restrain him. His purpose was to take him into custody. There may have come a time when his restraint was excessive in some way, but it never was his purpose or his intent. And so that's the description of that charge. And again, my understanding of why they didn't bring it, that they must have thought it would be a stretch to prove purpose to kill. So none of the charges require proof of purpose to kill. Each of the charges requires proof that Derek Chauvin engaged in conduct, which I take it is not a problem. He clearly engaged in conduct that we can argue was connected to the homicide of George Floyd, the neck restraint being the primary conduct. And we have to have a finding by the jury that that conduct caused the death of George Floyd. And again, from watching the video, it might seem as if causation would not be a difficult problem for the prosecution. One of the things that is most chilling about the video is the sense, which was testified to by the witnesses who were bystanders, some of whom taped the encounter. You get the sense that you are watching a person die. And you also get the sense that it is the neck restraint that is causing that death. The problem is that the medical examiner's autopsy report is somewhat unclear on this front. And I don't mean to suggest that it create, I don't mean to suggest for a minute that it creates an absolute obstacle to the prosecution, quite the contrary. But what the ME concluded is that George Floyd died of heart failure. I've got the technical terms in front of me, and I hope you can bear with me as I look for them. But the finding is that George Floyd died from cardiopulmonary arrest while being restrained by police officers. But the report then goes on to reveal that Mr. Floyd suffered from heart disease, hypertensive and arteriosclerotic heart disease. And it also stated that toxicology tests showed the presence of fentanyl, as well as evidence of recent methamphetamine use. And so when that ME report, the autopsy report, was first released, a lot of folks jumped on it to say that perhaps the neck restraint did not asphyxiate Mr. Floyd, that he died of a heart attack because of his pre-existing heart conditions and the effects of the drugs that were present in his system or that he had previously used. And so this is complicated. Causation often is a complicated concept. Deaths frequently are caused by more than one thing, if you will. But here the defense is going to argue strenuously that I believe from watching the trial or reading about the trial, that there is a reasonable doubt as to whether the neck restraint caused the death. There was an independent autopsy report commissioned by George Floyd's family, and it concluded, as did the medical examiner's report, that the death was a homicide. And the independent autopsy report singled out asphyxiation caused by the neck restraint as the cause of death. And so that report, which will also be introduced into evidence, is much more conclusive on the causation front. Again, both reports allow the jury to conclude that Chauvin's neck restraint was a substantial causal factor. That's what's required. I should have said that before. Causation requires the jury to find that the defendant's conduct was a substantial causal factor. But the problem is there's some confusion between the reports, and the concern on the side of the prosecution is that this confusion could create a doubt in the jury's mind. The jury may say, you know, we just aren't convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that the neck restraint caused the death. So causation is an issue. Again, it's not insurmountable. I just mention it to you because it is being litigated and it potentially will be heavily litigated in the defense case. So causation is an element that is under pressure in the case. The remaining elements in the cases that I want to talk about, so you have to have conduct, that is a substantial causal element in death. Those are the basic ingredients of homicide. And then above and beyond that, there are additional elements. And let's first of all take the depraved mind murder charge. That's the third degree murder charge. That, I understand, was the first charge that was brought against Derek Chauvin. Some of you may know that that charge was dismissed by the trial judge. The prosecution appealed, and an appellate court reinstated the third degree depraved mind charge. But we're still waiting to see whether the Minnesota Supreme Court might weigh in on that front and issue a ruling that the charge is improper. But let's just assume that the depraved mind charge is proper. And so the question for you, and yes, here is where I have to counsel my law students, the criminal law is just not terribly clear on this front. What is a depraved mind? I take it that you can at least wrap your arms around, your mind around, you can understand what it means to say that a defendant's purpose was to kill, the prosecution has to show that the defendant intended to take life. Well, what does it mean to say that we convict someone of murder when they did not intend to take life? That's the theory here. Chauvin did not intend to take life, but rather he acted with a depraved mind with respect to that outcome. And so depraved mind murder is an ancient definition of homicide. Minnesota, like many states, still follows it. These are definitions that were developed in England before the United States was founded, before the colonies were created. And it is, to our contemporary ears, a difficult term to explain, and we worry that juries won't understand it. So depraved mind, the essence seems to be that the defendant committed conduct that created a very, very grave risk of death. He didn't intend for anyone to die, but he went ahead and engaged in that risk-creating conduct, and he was utterly indifferent. He was callously and utterly indifferent to the possibility, indeed the probability, that death would occur. So there are some sort of classic cases of what we call depraved mind murder. People that play Russian roulette, for example, is the sort of classic case. The point being that there is the people who play that game are willing to undertake that risk to get the kicks that the risk provides, and they're willing to do that even though the risk is that one among them will die. So it's this sort of conduct where you don't intend someone to die, but you don't care if they do either. So that's kind of a vague definition. It leaves a lot of room for the jury to decide, did this defendant engage in this depraved kind of conduct? And I take it the prosecution's theory will be that there came a time during the 9 minutes when Derek Chauvin was restraining George Floyd's neck, where he went so far beyond the bounds of any kind of remotely possibly proper policing that he entered into this zone of extreme recklessness. And the thing that you're going to want to do here is to think about the third degree depraved mind murder charge together with the second degree manslaughter charge. The second degree manslaughter charge and the third degree depraved mind murder charge are similar. Again, neither requires proof of purpose or intent to kill, but both involve sort of a culpable mental state. In the case of third degree murder, it's some kind of extreme recklessness. You're fully aware of the risk you're running. And the manslaughter count is similar to that kind of conduct, but lesser in degree, in the sense that the defendant isn't as culpable, but is, or as callous to the value of human life, but is culpably negligent. So the defendant is aware that he's creating a risk. This is an unreasonable and substantial risk that brings him into criminal law territory, but it's less culpable than the third degree depraved mind murder. So both of those charges have causation problems attached to them. And then the question is, if the jury is deliberating between the two of them, will they think that the case involves proof of a kind of callous indifference to the value of Floyd's life, or merely culpable negligence, or that it wasn't negligent at all? The last charge I'll mention, and then I'm going to turn to the policing issues, is the second degree felony murder charge. So here, this is a very different kind of theory. And many of you may be hostile to felony murder if you are thinking about it in a general kind of context, if you're thinking about the whole universe of felony murder cases. But like the other two charges, the felony murder charge requires no proof of purpose to kill. Instead, what the prosecution must prove is that the defendant committed a qualifying felony, and in the course of carrying out that felony, he caused the death of another person. In these cases, there is no inquiry whatsoever into the defendant's mental state, his purpose, recklessness, or lack thereof with respect to the death. Got it? So this is a charge that is one of the darlings of prosecutors. Because again, once you show that the defendant committed the predicate felony, you have to show he committed conduct that amounted to a felony and he had the intent to that is necessary for that felony. Here, the underlying felony is assault. He committed assault and battery of George Floyd. And in the course of carrying out that felony, he caused Floyd's death. No inquiry whatsoever into mental state with respect to the killing that occurred. So these are the charges, and I'm really eager to hear what your questions are about the general criminal law principles. What I'm trying to do is to give you a snapshot of what these Minnesota statutes look like. And this has been rushed. It's a nutshell. This is a very complex area of the law. There's much more that I could say and will say if some of you want to follow up with me. So the next question that we have to consider, of course, is how does the fact that Derek Chauvin and his colleagues were police officers alter this landscape, right? Because the law that I've just described to you, I've had some references in my conversation to the fact that Chauvin was an officer. But I've described the law to you and in effect have asked you or invited you to think, oh, what if these folks were civilians? So it's impossible to imagine, but if you stop and think for a minute, if a civilian had committed the conduct that Derek Chauvin had committed, I take it it would be a very different kind of case, right? Just a really different kind of case. Why is that? Civilians have no authority to use force against each other. You are privileged to use force only in cases where you are defending yourself against the use of force. And there are restraints on our ability to use force against each other. We're forbidden to do that. Police officers, it's completely different. Police officers are authorized to apprehend, stop, and arrest criminal suspects. And in the course of doing that work, they are authorized to use force against the body of the subject. They are allowed to lay hands on the subject. They are allowed to use restraint on the subject if the subject tries to run away. And I mean, you all know this, right? And so, okay, that's the argument that the police officers are going to make. When we undertook this conduct, and it's true, we were authorized to place George Floyd under arrest for suspicion of using a counterfeit 20 to buy a pack of cigarettes. And he resisted arrest, and we tried a range of maneuvers to bring him into custody, and he continued to resist us. The upshot was we used these restraints, and alas, he died. And so how does the adding the police lens in change the dynamics of this trial? And it changes the dynamics of the trial quite dramatically. And I take it that this is one of the reasons why it has been in the past almost unheard of for officers to be prosecuted for killing or injuring subjects whom they are taking into custody. Very, very rare to see a prosecution, very rare to see a conviction. And so this area of the law is, again, complicated, somewhat difficult to describe concisely. But the basic mantra that is applied here is that officers have to be reasonable under all the circumstances. Officers are entitled to use the amount of force that is reasonable to subdue the particular subject that they are confronting under the particular circumstances that are occurring around them. The other thing that the courts do in this context is they will instruct juries that they are to consider the events from the perspective of a reasonable police officer in that encounter at the time of the encounter. They are not to use their 20/20 hindsight. It may turn out in these cases, and as we know, alas, it often turns out to be the case, that the person who was killed was not armed, or there's significant reason to doubt that the person posed a lethal threat. But the notion is, hindsight tells us that this was a tragic mistake, but at the time the officer acted, the claim goes by the defense, the officer was behaving reasonably. And we can see from watching the witnesses who are coming through already in the Chauvin trial that this issue was the use of the neck restraint reasonable, and at what point did it become unreasonable? I should say, at what point, if ever, did it become unreasonable? Because the defense is going to argue that it was reasonable throughout. Here's what I've been able to conclude, and then I'll stop and take your questions. It looks to me, and I'm not saying that you have to agree with any of this. That is not my mission here. I'm just trying to describe and invite us all to be thinking about the normative implications that emerge from this description. Again, when you're deciding whether officers' conduct is reasonable, you want to be thinking about the nature of the crime for which they're apprehending the suspect, the appearance, the physical strength of the suspect, obviously how the suspect is behaving in the moment, what kinds of accounts or narratives can the police tell about the particular risks that the suspect took? Were there threatening gestures? Were there movements that could be construed as reaching for a weapon? Was the defendant violent, acting out? All of those kinds of questions are going to come to the surface. And so with George Floyd, I take it that one big question in the case was the decision to place him under arrest at all. I've been trying to do research into the severity of the charge that the officers were investigating. They were there because he had allegedly used a counterfeit 20 to buy a pack of cigarettes. And it looks to me as if the Minnesota statutes say that if you pass counterfeit money that's worth less than $1,000, you face a year in prison and a fine of $3,000. You've got that statute and that judgment about the severity of the crime. Then the officers, of course, make the decision to take him into custody, and they are going to be pointing to evidence, and we've seen it on the videotape. If you've watched the videotape, they're going to claim that Floyd was agitated. They're going to claim that he was agitated from the very beginning. He refused to get into the police car. They tried to get him into the police car. They used various maneuvers to try to get him into the car, to try to restrain him. And he kept struggling and fighting and then ultimately ended up on the street. So I think that many of the experts are going to say that there was, the police were authorized to use some forms of restraint against George Floyd, at least under the police directives that existed. The question, of course, is the continued use of the neck restraint after Floyd was on the ground. And from my eyes and from the eyes of many experts, including officers in Chauvin's own department, Floyd was no longer resisting. He was not resisting. Again, we now know he was dying. Here, what I've been able to glean, and I'm just speculating now, is that the officers are going to claim that in their training, they are told that suspects often do this. They will stop struggling. They will feign that he was feigning, that he was pretending that he had ceased resisting, but that he might at any time rise up against them. And so that it was necessary for them to continue restraining him because they couldn't be sure that he wouldn't suddenly sort of come back to life and start resisting and fighting again. The other thing that they're going to probably raise is the fact that they have reason to believe, they will say, that he was under the influence of drugs. There is some evidence out there that I've been able to read that suggests that they were told by the folks at Cup Foods that he seemed like he was high and he was behaving in a very agitated way. And they will again claim that their training shows them that people who are under the influence of drugs can, again, often be extremely unpredictable, seem to be complying at one moment, and then rise up and start fighting again. So they will make that argument. Another argument that I've been really fascinated to notice and that the prosecution is trying to work with is that they seem to be poised to claim, the thought is the defense is trying to develop the case that the crowd distracted the officers, that the officers confronted a very difficult set of circumstances. They had this man who would not comply. He was clearly high, they will say, and they were struggling to control him. And suddenly you had this crowd on site that was becoming unruly and that was interfering with their ability to carry out their duties as officers. And, you know, that could possibly be a causation argument, right? That it was the crowd who caused the death by distracting the officers. I don't know how that would work. But just that this was a very volatile, very difficult scene. The officers had a whole lot going on. And that in the moment, it was necessary for them to keep Floyd under control, to try to control the crowd and so on and so forth. Again, my understanding is that the prosecution is pushing back against that claim, that theory, by showing the people and presenting the people as witnesses, the people who were in the crowd, and making it clear that this was a small group of people that were pleading with the officers to save George Floyd's life. So the question of whether the jury will believe that this use of force, though it seems to be plainly criminal, indeed murderous, if it were used by a civilian, that in the circumstances, the officers were authorized to use this level of force to take the man into custody and to restrain him once he started to fight with them. So those are going to be some of the difficult issues that I see arising. So Chauvin is on trial now. He faces the two murder counts, felony murder and depraved mind murder, plus second degree manslaughter. And then in the future, we may see the other three officers tried on the theory that they assisted him, that they were his accomplices, and therefore that they should be guilty of the same crimes that he committed. And I took a look at those complaints and did a bunch of reading about accomplice liability in Minnesota. Minnesota appears to have a somewhat more stringent approach to accomplice liability. It may require more conduct by the accomplice. What you're looking for is to hold someone liable as an accomplice that these officers were aiders and abettors of Derek Chauvin, you have to show that they provided some assistance, that they did something that helped him complete the homicide, and that they shared his whatever mental state is required for the underlying crime, whether it be the intent to assault or the culpable negligence associated with manslaughter. And at first I thought that it might be the case that some of the officers would say, we were just there. You know, we saw what was going on. We knew that he was restraining, but we didn't do anything. And some of the early videotapes, it was difficult to see what the other officers were doing. But as I read the criminal complaints and look at the more complex videos that have emerged, it seems to be quite clear that two of the officers also physically restrained George Floyd during the 9 minutes. One was positioned in restraining Floyd's legs. The other was restraining Floyd's back. And so those officers had hands on and were actually participating in the restraint that the prosecution argues caused the death. And the other officer, who was not physically restraining, engaged in various forms of conduct that prevented the bystanders. He actively prevented bystanders from coming in and rendering aid, and so forth. So these three officers will not be in the same position as Derek Chauvin, and their theories of defense may well diverge. They are going to claim he was our superior officer, we are police officers, and it was reasonable for us. Again, if the question is whether our conduct was reasonable in the moment, under the circumstances, it was reasonable for us to follow the lead of our superior. So I hope this has helped you. I hope that this helps you to understand what the stakes are before the jury, that the jury is going to be looking at these technical but somewhat vague homicide definitions. And obviously, they are going to be thinking about the overlay of policing. Was it reasonable for the police to believe that it was necessary for them to use this force? But those are the technical stakes in the criminal case. And the thing that was striking to me as I was doing the reading is that it's possible that we would conclude that the officers did use excessive force, but that they're not guilty of homicide. There's space between those two conclusions, and you can see that most clearly in the area of causation. So the notion would be, yeah, this neck restraint was excessive. It was unreasonable. It was way out there, above and beyond any training that a reasonable police department would authorize. It was absolutely not appropriate, reasonable, in any shape, way, shape, or form. But the defendant would argue, okay, that may be so, but he died because he had a drug overdose, something along those lines. So I just want you to be alert to these problems and the complexity of the homicide definitions as you move forward, thinking about how they interact with the policing questions.
That was Anne Coughlin, professor of law at the Virginia School of Law. Next, we'll hear from Keith Ellison, attorney general in the state of Minnesota, reading a statement following the three guilty verdicts in the Derek Chauvin trial.
The people who stopped and raised their voices on May 25th, 2020, were a bouquet of humanity, a phrase I stole from my friend Jerry Blackwell. A bouquet of humanity, old, young, men and women, black and white, a man from the neighborhood just walking to get a drink, a child going to buy a snack with her cousin, an off-duty firefighter on her way to a community garden, brave young women, teenagers, who press record on their cell phones. Why did they stop? They didn't know George Floyd. They didn't know he had a beautiful family. They didn't know he had been a great athlete. And they didn't know he was a proud father or that he had people in his life who loved him. They stopped and raised their voices, and they even challenged authority because they saw his humanity. They stopped and they raised their voices because they knew that what they were seeing was wrong. They didn't need to be medical professionals or experts in the use of force. They knew it was wrong, and they were right. These community members, this bouquet of humanity, did it again in this trial. They performed simple yet profound acts of courage. They told the truth, and they told the whole world the truth about what they saw. They were vindicated by the chief of police, by Minneapolis's longest-serving police officer, and by many other police officers who stepped up and testified as to what they saw and to what they knew. What happened on that street was wrong. We owe it, and we owe our gratitude to fulfilling their, we owe them our gratitude for fulfilling their civic duty and for their courage in telling the truth. To countless people in Minnesota and across the United States who joined them in peacefully demanding justice for George Floyd, we say, all of us, thank you. In the coming days, more may seek to express themselves again through petition and demonstration. I urge everyone to honor the legacy of George Floyd by doing so calmly, legally, and peacefully. I urge everyone to continue the journey to transformation and justice. It's in your hands now. I also want to address the Floyd family, if I may. Over the last year, the family of George Floyd had to relive again and again the worst day of their lives when they lost their brother, their father, their friend. I'm profoundly grateful to them for giving us the time we needed to prosecute this case. They have shown the world what grace and class and courage really look like. Although a verdict alone cannot end their pain, I hope it's another step on the long path toward healing for them. There's no replacing your beloved Perry, or Floyd, as his friends called him, but he is the one who sparked a worldwide movement, and that's important. Although the verdict has been rendered, this is not the end. In the coming weeks, the court will determine sentencing, and later this summer, we expect to present another case. We will not be talking about that. This verdict reminds us how hard it is to make enduring change. And I just want to finish by sharing some important historical legacy, if you allow me. In 1968, the Kerner Commission was formed to investigate the causes of uprisings across major American cities. And a man named Dr. Kenneth Clark, a famous African-American psychologist, who, along with his equally accomplished psychologist wife, Mamie, contributed to compelling research in the Brown versus Board of Education case. And Dr. Clark testified at the Kerner Commission. And I want to quote you what he said. I read that report, the one in the 1919 riot in Chicago, and it was as if I were reading the report of investigating the committee of the Harlem riot in 1935, the report on investigating the Harlem riot in 1943, and the report of the McCone Commission on the Watts riot. I must say again in candor to you, the members of this commission, it's like a kind of an Alice in Wonderland with the same moving picture reshown over and over again, the same analysis, the same recommendation, and the same in action. Those are the words of Dr. Clark in 1968. Here we are in 2021. Here we are in 2021, still addressing the same problem. Since Dr. Clark testified, we have seen Rodney King, Abner Louima, Oscar Grant, Eric Garner, Michael Brown, Freddie Gray, Sandra Bland, Philando Castile, Laquan McDonald, Stephon Clark, Atiana Jefferson, Anton Black, Breonna Taylor, and now Dante Wright and Adam Toledo. This has to end. We need true justice. That's not one case. That is a social transformation that says that nobody's beneath the law and no one is above it. This verdict reminds us that we must make enduring, systemic, societal change. More than a month ago, months before George Floyd was murdered, The Minnesota Public Safety Commissioner John Harrington and I released the recommendations of our working group on reducing deadly force encounters with law enforcement. What all of us in that working group, including law enforcement, wanted is for everyone to go home safe. Anytime someone doesn't, everyone's lives are changed forever. We need to use this verdict as an inflection point. What if we just prevented the problem instead of having to try these cases? We don't want any more community members dying at the hands of law enforcement and their families' lives ruined. We don't want any more law enforcement members having to face criminal charges and their families' lives ruined. We don't want any more communities torn apart. One way to prevent this is to get into a new relationship where we as a society re-examine the use of force and our old settled assumptions. I'm so proud of Chief Arredondo and the Minneapolis police officers who by their testimony said enough is enough. And another way to prevent it is by acknowledging and lifting up everyone's humanity, helping communities heal and officers be well. Another way to prevent it is with accountability. Passing laws and instituting policies and training is important, but they must be more than words on paper, and there must be accountability for violating them. With this verdict, we have brought some accountability. Finally, this verdict demands us to never give up the hope that we can make enduring change. Generations of people said slavery would never end. Generations said Jim Crow would never end. Generations said women would never be equal to men. Generations said if you were different in any way, you could never be a full and equal member of our society. Today, we have to end this travesty of recurring, enduring deaths at the hands of law enforcement. Those beliefs are things we have to focus our attention on. And as I now do close, I just want to say to you, the work of our generation is to put unaccountable law enforcement behind us. It's time to transform the relationship between community and the people who are sworn to protect them from one that is mistrustful, suspicious, and in some cases terrifying, into one that is empathetic, compassionate, and affirming. That will benefit everyone, including police officers who deserve to serve in a profession that is honored, in departments where they don't have to worry about colleagues who don't follow the rules. Now that work is in your hands. The work of our generation is to put an end to the vestiges of Jim Crow and the centuries of trauma, and finally put an end to racism. We can end it. It doesn't have to be with us into the future if we decide now to have true liberty and justice for all. The work of our generation is to say goodbye to old practices that don't serve us anymore and to put them all behind us. One conviction, even one like this one can create a powerful new opening to shed old practices and reset relationships. So with that, I just want to say that I do hope that people step forward and understand that nobody can do everything, but everybody can do something. You can do something the way like everyday people like Donald Williams and Genevieve Hansen and Christopher Martin and Charles McMillan and all those teenagers and young people stepped up and did something. You can do things like help pass the George Floyd Justice and Accountability Act. It's in your hands. Let's get the work done.
Keith Ellison, Minnesota's State Attorney General. Lastly, to offer a broader context, here is New York Congressperson Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
I think for a lot of us that have been in this fight for justice, in this fight for establishing true safety for our communities, hearing this verdict come in can create... Can you guys hear me? You can hear me? Okay. Hearing this verdict come in, I think creates a lot of complex emotions for a lot of us. You know, like you can be holding a lot of things at once, right? Like on one hand, people are saying, finally, like, yes, like something's happening. And on the other hand, this not feeling like justice. And I want to just let you all know and create the affirmation that this isn't justice. It's not justice. And I'll explain to you why it's not justice. It's not justice because justice is George Floyd going home tonight to be with his family. Justice is Adam Toledo getting tucked in by his mom tonight. Justice is when you're pulled over, there not being a gun that's part of that interaction because you have a headlight out. Justice is your school system not having or being part of a school to prison pipeline. Justice is a municipality and a government that does not, because it trickles down, right? That does not value military and armaments more than it values healthcare and education and housing. So no, this verdict is not justice. Frankly, I don't even think we call it full accountability because there are multiple officers that were there. It wasn't just Derek Chauvin. And I also don't want this moment to be framed as this system working, because it's not working. And that's what creates a lot of complexity in this moment. Because the fact that we were all glued to our television sets because we knew, we saw a murder in front of all of our eyes, and yet we didn't know if there would be a guilty verdict, it tells you everything. And that's why I think it's really important that this verdict is not used as a replacement for policy change. Derek Chauvin is one of the first officers, I believe he's the 8th officer found guilty for murder since 2005. More than 15 years. That's not justice. And so we have a lot of work to do, because verdicts are not a replacement for policy change. Verdicts are not a substitute. You know, a jury doing its job in its system is not a replacement for us doing our job in that system. And there are way too many people, including my colleagues, that think that's the case. George Floyd Justice and Policing Act. Is it important? Yes. Does it solve the issue ultimately? No. This is not about cameras and retraining and chokeholds. This is about changing how we structure our society and the valuing of Black life. So yeah, there's legislation in here that's not bad. That's important. That should be passed. But even a lot of that doesn't hit the core, because politically, it has been something that politicians have not been allowed to talk about for a long time. And I'm okay saying that. This is not about a party. I mean, obviously Republicans got issues, but Democrats have a lot to contend with too. Not good enough. We really got to talk about how democratically controlled cities still pump and pump and pump police budgets. We got to talk about that. We got to talk about, even when those Democratic cities pump up those police budgets, do the rape kit logs go down? No. We got what's happening in New York City, where it goes to buying robo dogs. So Money's not the problem here.
Thanks for tuning in this week. This has been Conscious Voices, heard each week at this time in your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and on WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll hope to see you all again next week at this time for another edition.